This is Far From Home. I'm Scott Gurian. So you buy the guidebook, you do the research, you spend weeks planning the entire itinerary for this trip you've been looking forward to for the longest time. All the details are worked out, and you're expecting everything will go according to plan. But then, you get caught in traffic and you miss your flight, or maybe you lose your passport somewhere along the way. You make a wrong turn and become horribly lost, or I know it sounds crazy, but you're traveling abroad and suddenly there's a global pandemic. Of course, that would never happen. But here's my point. When you travel, especially if you're in a distant and unfamiliar place, it's inevitable that sooner or later things will happen that are beyond your control. You're thrown a curveball, and you've got to do your best to stay calm, be creative, and improvise. If you've listened to the past few seasons of this show, you know that there have been plenty of instances in my travels when I've gotten caught in unexpected and sometimes even frightening situations. Times when I found myself out of my comfort zone, navigating entirely new terrain and trying my best to sort things out. On today's episode, I'm going to feature two stories from friends of mine who ended up in situations they never imagined through no fault of their own. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from Donna Salter, who's been on this podcast before, about what happened when she got stranded on a little tiny boat in the middle of a very big ocean. But first, I want to introduce you to Graham Marsden.
Personally, I've traveled to about 60 countries, 49 U.S. states.
And his wife, Sarah.
I've been to 47 countries.
Maybe about 40 of those together.
Yeah. Graham is so good at making itineraries. And I do some brief research a little bit, but mostly when it comes to like when and where we're going to be, I just kind of trust he's going to take me to safe places because it's always been great. So there's never been a reason to not trust that.
What could go wrong?
Well, lots, actually. And this is the story of one time things definitely didn't go quite the way they were planned.
We had the wonderful fortune of having a friend who was serving in the diplomatic service for the United States. So we decided to pay a visit. And one of our approaches is to kind of do the hard things first when we visit a new region of the world. And so I wanted to not just go to the Middle East for my first trip and, you know, bathe in luxury and just move easily from place to place. I was like, no, we're going to take an overnight train from Damascus to Aleppo. We are going to rent a car where we can, which for some people might be an insane proposition. We'll take public transit, buses, whatever we need to do to move around in this region.
Now, I should jump in here to explain this was back in late 2010, shortly before the start of the Arab Spring and about 8 months before Syria would become enveloped in civil war. So at the time, things were pretty peaceful and visiting Syria didn't seem like too big of a deal.
So we had briefly been in the northern part of Syria for a few days and decided to transit through Lebanon and through the city of Beirut on our way to Damascus. So just taking a little bit of a detour as we moved south in order to experience this amazing city and its food and to really follow in the footsteps of our dear Anthony Bourdain. May he rest in peace. And in doing that, we set ourselves up for a great couple of days. We had one night in Beirut, stayed at a nicely located, you know, simple hotel. And that hotel was near the American University. They had a referral network of English-speaking taxi drivers. The driver accompanied us through the day and took us on essentially this driving tour of great food destinations.
Oh, that dinner was so good.
Yeah.
The fish.
Yeah, just great, great meals. Something went wrong at one of these restaurants, though, and Sarah tried something that I didn't have, and she began to fall ill as the day wound to a close, and we were moving toward our border crossing back into Damascus.
I was just kind of making those beginning sounds of illness, that kind of, kind of feeling.
Feel that anxiety building.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're winding up these mountain roads to the cedars of Lebanon and up and over the range and then down into the valley where most of the wine in Lebanon is produced. And now I know this valley is, at the time, was pretty much Hezbollah controlled. And I had already made some decisions to not really get out of the car and go see a couple of the other historic sites that would have been absolutely brilliant to see and wonderful to photograph. But I just didn't want to risk it with the footprint that Hezbollah had and sort of the stronghold that they had in that particular region.
Sarah, did Graham share his concerns with you? And were you aware that you were driving through this sort of dangerous area?
I was busy thinking about the stronghold happening in my gut.
Yeah, so in the moment, I think Sarah's attention to everything that we're about to describe was diverted toward just maintaining her own physical constitution. It was kind of like, oh, I've got a wounded duck in the backseat of this taxi with me, and I don't know how it's going to work out. So our first driver gets us up to the closest town to the border. And unfortunately, he didn't have papers to cross over into Syria. So he's like, now I need to find you another driver. I need to hand you off, essentially. So he pulls into this town where there's just a gaggle of male taxi drivers. They're just basically knocking on the glass and trying to get our business, like flag it down. And it was a cacophony. And our driver wisely pulled up and away from that scene, and he said, watch this. Now, the one who really wants your business is going to have enough follow-through to get in his car and to track us down two blocks down the street. And whoever follows us, that's the one that you'll take. And sure enough, within 30 seconds or so, one of those guys pulled up behind us in his vehicle. And a brief exchange between our driver and the other driver. We transfer our baggage, including thousands of dollars worth of camera gear and all of our possessions, into the other car. And our wonderful previous English-speaking driver put us into the back seat, and he said, whatever you do, just don't let anyone else get in the car.
As if that's in our power.
Yeah.
To say, hey, why are you in the car? Can you please leave?
Well, we didn't know why that was a warning, but it was given to us. And he also spoke in Arabic to the other driver and said, you know, these are my Habibti, take good care of them. You know, I've been watching these guys all day, et cetera, et cetera. You could pick up a little bit of contextual clues that maybe he wasn't 100% confident about our safety, but he was vouching for the process here and gave us some assurances. So we get in this other car and start driving toward the border. And it's nighttime now, and Sarah's largely... Yeah, mostly horizontal now, and
not good.
Really not paying attention. From Lebanon into Syria, it was a no man's land, about 7 miles long, with about a half dozen different checkpoints along the way. So it seemed like they had a system. We're doing it in the dark. You know, it's an hour past sunset. We got through maybe three or four of these checkpoints before we got to the immigration building, and we got out of our car. Our driver just pointed to the building. We know we've got our American passports. We go up to the window. They stamp it. It's rather perfunctory. We had our visas in line. It all checks out. We get back to our car, and I hesitate to describe using nationality, but I believe I'm correct in saying there was a diminutive, maybe 100-pound Indonesian man carrying a briefcase and wearing a gray suit, sitting in the passenger seat of our car. And I didn't even ask you what you thought in the moment, Sarah. Like, did you have any thoughts? Like, you see this guy?
I just thought, this is what you're supposed to do. We can't tell him to get out of the car, even though we were told, don't let anybody in the car.
It seemed almost planned, which it probably was. And my thinking in that moment is, okay, well, I can probably take him. Like, if this guy tries to fight us, he's small, and I'm pretty sure I could take him. So I kind of sized him up in that way, like, not a threat, you know? And I was like, okay, well, this is really weird, but also we're in the middle of this border crossing situation. We're in a no man's land. We knew we had multiple checkpoints ahead. And we also didn't speak the language of the driver. Also, our camera bag is in there, all our stuff. Like, I'm not going to abandon the vehicle now, right?
Good point.
And it's dark.
That's our only choice.
Yeah. We're stuck in this vehicle wherever it's going. Now, that may have been a very risky decision to make, but I don't think there's anything we could have done differently. So we got back in the car. The guy turns around, smiles at us, super polite, and just they nod and we start driving again.
Does the driver acknowledge in any way, okay, there's someone new in the car now?
No. And in fact, he turned up the radio and it seemed like an angry, either political or religious radio show that was just going on and on and on. Sounded like the Rush Limbaugh of Syria. So we go through a couple more checkpoints and I saw with my eyes and I realized what was happening. The border crossing guards were letting our car through, only checking our American passports. They were putting their little stamps, signatures, pen markings on our passports. They were not asking for any papers or identification from our passenger, our well-dressed man carrying only a briefcase. They just ignored him, like he wasn't there at all. I mean, he looked well-composed. He looked calm.
He was calm.
Super calm. He just seemed to know exactly what he was doing. He was sitting in that front seat, getting through the border on our passports is what he was doing. At this point, Sarah's like really, really in a bad place. So I'm worried on two fronts. I've got a threat possibly in front of me. I've got a crisis situation to my left. And we just need to get to our hotel because now I know this is a bit of an ordeal. So we get through the final checkpoints and now there's a stretch of highway that just is nothing for a while, still kind of in the desert or, you know, uninhabited, unpopulated part of the country. Nobody wants to live close to that border, let's be honest. So our driver starts going 100 miles per hour, not kilometers, but miles per hour on the highway. And this was disconcerting.
I thought it was great because that means I get to the hotel quicker.
That's fair. It started to feel very efficient.
I gotta go to the bathroom.
You know? After all those checkpoints and you know the slow crawl of getting through, it was extremely efficient for the next 5 minutes or so, until our driver pulled up behind a station wagon, flashed his lights, and both cars pull over underneath a bridge, an overpass. And I'm thinking, okay, we're about to get kidnapped and beheaded. To be honest, I really had that fear. It was palpable. And in the other car that pulled over, there were about 8 men. So now my equation, my calculation of, oh, I could take this guy is thrown way off because I can't take 8 guys. And we're underneath a bridge. So automatically I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what kind of border crossing situation have we gotten ourselves into? This is about to become an international incident. We might be kidnapped or worse. I think I was having that fight or flight reaction, but I knew the decision on flight had already been made because I'm not going to leave without her and she can't move. So I was actually really preparing for fight inside. But as soon as I saw 8 other guys in this other car, I knew nothing I could do was going to matter. At that point, it was a moment of surrender, to be honest.
Sarah, you're laying on the back seat. You're not seeing what's going on ahead. Graham, are you doing like play-by-play or whatever? Are you telling her what's going on out the window or you're just keeping silent?
I was silent. First of all, it's also the shock of even going through a situation like that. Like you don't know how you're going to react.
Maybe
I should probably have
attention.
Communicated we are in a potentially life-threatening situation.
Maybe you did. Maybe you did say that. I just don't remember.
Yeah, I may have said, hey...
Hey, I don't like
this. This is
weird. You could have easily have said something like
hold on to your stuff. We shouldn't be stopped. You know, some simple things like that, but probably not like, hey, any minute now we might be abducted. I saw money changing hands between our driver and the driver of the other car. And the man in the front seat of our car simply got out of the car, went into the other car, climbed in with the other 8 guys, and they sped off into the night. Thank goodness. Because they didn't take us with them. I think that was my realization, was like that we were possibly that close to some sort of human... Well, we had already done the human trafficking, unbeknownst to us, out of our control. But we might have been trafficked ourselves in that scenario. So our driver gets back in the car. He gets in the driver's seat, looks back at us, and in perfect English, which he had not spoken a word of to us before, he said, I'm not taking you to your hotel. And... after a pause, I mean, I'm like, what? He's like, I don't have time. I'm just going to take you to Central Damascus. I'll drop you off.
And we're like, okay, that's fine.
Fine.
That's fine. Great.
Fine.
I think I was grateful that I could make sounds of agony again.
You didn't have to be polite for our guests?
I didn't have to be polite for our guests. I could be like, drive faster again. Remember when you drove fast?
Yeah.
Can you do that again?
So you probably experienced some relief in like, okay, it's back to us and our driver. We can control that situation better.
Yeah. Sure.
We had another half hour. He sped on. We got into the city. And thankfully, we had just enough of our bearings to know where our hotel would be because he dropped us off basically at a train station. And still sick. Now we have to walk 20, 30 minutes to find our hotel and finally put our heads in bed. Well, where Sarah spent the next 3 days.
Toilet first for me. My memory gets more and more foggy thinking about it and just knowing that I had such a singular motivation of survival, which was just, I just don't want to make a mess in this car. I mean, looking back, it's like, oh, this was all pretty innocent. You know, another guy got in the taxi. It was very efficient. That's one less car on the road. And, oh, he's meeting up with his friends. Okay, so he's getting in that car. Great. Like, I just didn't perceive it as being anything sinister. Like, I didn't witness the changing of money or any of that. I just thought, oh, this guest is here and now he's not. And now we've got to walk to the hotel. That's inconvenient, but we have no choice. There's nothing I could do.
So when you think back on this now, what do you think was going on?
I think he was a Jamal Islamiya terrorist. That's like an Indonesian branch of Al-Qaeda. And, you know, this was peacetime, but it was still a rocky time in that particular part of that country. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if that was a briefcase full of money or even, you know, chemical agents or something like that. I have no idea.
I'm curious what you think about this whole experience now in retrospect and now that some time has passed.
I can only think of it in context of the unrest and the conflict that appeared in the region within months of us being there. And, you know, it's a situation I would rather not have experienced. It's certainly like, okay, well, now you've earned your stripes as a traveler. Like, you know, you've traveled the world when you accidentally smuggle someone into Syria. It's also a story that we were hesitant to tell for a few years because of the conflict and because of the notion that our actions may have inadvertently, you know, triggered some sort of escalation or enabled that in some way. And I can't say it's our actions. It was our inaction. It was our inability to speak up for ourselves in that moment and say, no, this person doesn't belong in our car. But what would have happened then? Like, I have no idea. What really was amazing for me was recognizing the perilous nature of that experience. And then the Arab Spring starts, then the Syrian conflict starts. And now journalists for the next 3 to 4 years are smuggling themselves across the border into Syria, into Aleppo, Damascus.
Maybe that guy was a journalist.
Yeah, maybe he was an Indonesian bomb-making journalist. I'm convinced, with a briefcase full of journals.
Maybe he was, like, delivering an important message across the border.
We'll never know.
We'll never know. He could have been the most amazing hero of the story.
And he's probably on a podcast about this one time he figured out a way to get into Syria before the Arab Spring and used some unwitting Americans in order to do so.
I like that narrative.
When she's not traveling, Sarah Marsden is a comedian, musician, singer, and photographer living in Denver. Her husband, Graham, is the founder of a travel company ironically called Don't Go Travel, which promotes ethical and responsible tourism. If you get a chance, you should go read his manifesto at his website, don'tgo.travel. He also hosts a podcast called Don't Go Unless, where I was actually a guest a few months ago discussing my trip to Cambodia. If you want to hear more, I've linked to it from my website as well as in the show notes. So you might remember Donna Salter, who's made a brief appearance in several past episodes. As a reminder, after I drove 11,000 miles from the UK to Mongolia with my brother and my friends Jane and Rosie in season one of this podcast, Donna flew out to Siberia to join me on the journey back to Europe. The reason I invited her is because Donna's one of the most adventurous people I know, and she has tons of great stories from her travels around the world. In keeping with my theme of experiences when people ended up way outside their comfort zones, here's Donna's tale of how to roll with the punches and not let a really bad situation ruin your travel plans.
I grew up in a small town in northern British Columbia. We were living in the mountains, in the Rocky Mountains, and We were all deciding what we'd rather be doing than working at the Banff Springs Hotel on New Year's Eve. And I said I'd rather be standing in Times Square. And somehow we forgot to go to work because we'd had a lot of beer. And so we got fired. And so coming to Times Square for New Year's Eve sounded like a good idea. I arrived in New York, and I wasn't an American, but I was faking it. My story was, so that nobody would discover that I was living illegally here, was that I came from just slightly north of Seattle. And I was busted on that one because some guy asked me about some store in Seattle that I was supposed to know. Well, of course, north of Seattle was Canada, but he didn't know that. So my boss said that there was a lottery and that I could apply for citizenship. He told me he would pay all the postage and everything. And I entered and entered and entered, and I sent in 365 letters because I figured one for every day of the year. And I still didn't get picked. So I answered an ad in the Village Voice to sail to Europe. And I thought I knew what I was doing. I did sort of say that I was an experienced sailor, and I wasn't really. I guess I didn't think about the danger, and the whole point of it was that these people seemed to know what they were doing. But in retrospect, they had never sailed out of sight of the yacht club, and we were in big trouble almost immediately. I flew down to Fort Lauderdale, and we set out from the yacht club and started sailing. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience, as the kind of the grubby water of the coast slipped away, and you get into this beautiful, deep, navy blue water. I can't even describe it. It's so beautiful. But you see nothing. There's no land. There's nothing except the ocean and the sky, and you're on this boat, and you're going along, and everything's fine. About the second day out, you start to get really, really sick. But, you know, that passes, and then a sail tour, and we had no way to sail the boat except for one mainsail and no way to fix it. And then the alternator broke, and then we were really in trouble because once the alternator broke, all the power went out, and we had no way of, you know, getting the batteries up again. So we had no communication system. We had nothing. No navigation system, no running lights, nothing. And then the wind just stopped. So we had no motor either. So we're just kind of sitting in the middle of the ocean, and we're swimming around the boat in circles. I'm thinking about sharks. And the meat that was in the freezer is rotting, and there's no fresh food. Everything was refrigerated because they hadn't thought about this ahead of time. And what we were left with was peppers and mustard, like jars and jars of jalapeno peppers, which you don't really want to eat when you have no water. And the water that was in the tanks, by now the boat had just been sort of bobbing in the sea, so the water that was in the tanks had been stirred up sufficiently that it really, when it came out, it looked like Coca-Cola. It was ridiculous. There was a cat and a dog on board, and they were going to the bathroom, but nobody knew where they were going to the bathroom. And you could smell it, but the whole thing, because there had been this meat in the refrigerator and everything, it sort of rotted. And, oh, God, at the time, there was something called the Islip Garbage Barge. And Long Island couldn't get rid of its garbage. And there was this barge floating around, and nobody wanted it. And that's sort of what we smelled like. It was very smelly and not so good. We sat there for a long time, and we drifted, and we tried to do direct navigation and tried to figure out where we were going. I swear, the Atlantic Ocean is a very big ocean, and Bermuda is a very small island. And at night, when we would be sitting up doing watches, I would see lights. But in the end, we didn't know whether we were hallucinating or, you know, what was happening. And finally, we saw a fishing boat. And I stood on the bow and said, "Get me off of this boat." And they took me off of the boat. And we found Bermuda. And that was the story on the way to Bermuda. I really wanted to get to Europe, and this was, I had no money, and I'd been in New York for a long time with no money, and so I had no way of getting to Europe. So the only way I figured I could get to Europe was by getting on another boat. And also I felt that I would never want to sail on a boat again unless I got right back on another one. When we were coming into Bermuda on the other boat, I overheard a radio transmission from a boat called Speedwell. And there was a tropical depression at the time. And he was very calmly talking on the radio saying, you know, ship station, this is Speedwell calling. We've had a little bit of inclement weather. And meanwhile, there's a storm raging around us and he's pulling into Bermuda. And I think, oh, that's the kind of boat I want to get on. Somebody who's very calm in a storm. And so I wandered down to the docks and there were all sorts of boats. And I started asking if anybody needed crew. And there was a guy scrubbing some mats. And he said, well, I could take on another person. He was English. So I went onto the boat and I started asking him questions. And I asked him so many questions. He was just looking at me and I'm like, how much water have you got on board? And I want to know what kind of power supply you have. And do you have an extra alternator in case one breaks? And what would you do if a sail ripped? And he had everything. He had a sewing machine and an extra alternator. And he even had a spare porthole. But he was laughing because I'm asking him to let me sail with him, but I'm interviewing him. Oh, he said, you must have come in on that garbage barge over there because the boat just looked like it was such a mess. And I said, yep. And he said, all right. He said, come with me. I'm going to show you how real sailors do it. I said, well, I'm not so sure yet. I have a few more questions. And he took out a book and he pointed out a paragraph. And there was a paragraph about a sailor who had gone across the pond many, many times. And he said, that's me. So it's okay. You're all right. You're in good hands. I've done this before. And as it turns out, I was. And of course, we'd been very hungry on the last boat and there'd been no water. And we got on this boat, and just even as we were pulling out of Bermuda, Bermuda has all these beautiful pastel-colored houses, and as we were pulling out, there was this sort of snap and whine, and we caught our first fish, and it was a dorado. And so we had fresh fish that night and a lovely dinner, and then all of a sudden we're away from anything, and instead of feeling trapped in this kind of vast, like, where are we and where are we going to find? I just felt this exquisite freedom. And it was just spectacular. And we were going so fast all the time. And it was really, really sailing. And we ripped a sail. And out came the sewing machine. And we fixed the sail. And we made it to the Azores, which is a group of islands about 2,000 miles off the coast of Portugal in just record time. And it was just fantastic. It was the greatest trip of my life. It was the greatest experience of my life. And largely because I think it's one of the few places you can be that you can really feel a complete kind of freedom. You know, we're so tied to electronic gadgets and stuff like that. And we weren't at that time because that was before computers and the internet and all of that. But there was no telephone. There was no way that anybody could have gotten a hold of me. They just couldn't. So I was there and I was kind of myself challenging the universe. And that's really how I felt. Like, we had a tremendously bad storm at one point. And I was in my bed. It was the middle of the night. And all of a sudden I heard a bang. And I woke up and then I heard all hands on deck. And we all got suited up and it was pouring rain, and there was lightning and thunder, and it was dark, and there were waves like mountains coming behind us and just pushing the boat over, and I was scared to death. And the captain of the boat said, we've got to get the jib down. And he said, you got to go out there. And I had to run onto the foredeck, and he didn't believe in tying on to the boat because he thought that would be more dangerous if you got dropped into the water. So I wasn't tied on to anything. I had to crawl out on my hands and knees out onto the bowsprit and take this pole in and run it back into a cleat on the deck. And I remember my watch snapping off and looking after this watch, which I quite liked at the time, and thinking, oh, I just better go in after it. And I thought that would be far better than being on this boat. It was being in the ocean dead. And it was a great thing because this storm raged all night. And I remember finally at about, 7 o'clock the next morning, things started to settle down and there was sort of this pale gray morning and the waves had stopped and we were all kind of sick and sitting in the cockpit and soaking wet. And somebody made hot chocolate. And I thought, I beat death. I beat death. And it was such an exhilarating feeling because it was like you and the universe, you know? Like you fought this thing off and you could have easily died. You could have easily fallen overboard. And at that point, if you'd fallen overboard, nobody would ever find you again. But I didn't. And it was a very exhilarating feeling.
Thanks so much to Donna Salter for sharing her story. If you want to hear about another one of her adventures, hitching a ride across the ocean on a cargo ship, I've linked to an interview she did on my website, as well as in the show notes. Remember, you could follow Far From Home on Instagram, Facebook, and Clubhouse, and follow me on Twitter, where I'm at Scott Gurian. If you're new to the show, check out my website at farfromhomepodcast.org and delve back into my archives. And as always, you could get in touch at info@farfromhomepodcast.org. Until next time, thanks for listening.